Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Lonnie Davis. I'm the representative of the appellant in this case, Mr. Rafford. We are here this morning, I believe, to present two issues. But before I get to those issues, I want to say initially that we are not in any way challenging Judge Thorpe's concern about providing a fair trial. We think his obligation to do that was fundamental. We have no question that he did so. We're here before the court this morning because we have a situation almost exactly like the one presented in the case of Duval versus Kitsap County. We have a man with a severe hearing impairment who needs an accommodation so that he can observe his son's trial. He is denied an accommodation that is effective, and the county is acting in a deliberate manner when it denies that.
I see. Yeah, that's what I see as the issue, whether or not there was deliberate indifference, which is a fairly high standard to me.
It is a high standard, Your Honor. And before I get to the answer, may I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal,
right,
if I could? It is a high standard, but we think it is clearly met here. There's no question that they knew of Mr. Rafford's hearing impairment.
They did provide him with a certain accommodation, but he wanted something else, correct? He wanted real time.
He wanted real time.
Is there any case that stands for the proposition that he gets to pick what the accommodation is?
The federal regulations make it clear that the county is to give primary consideration to the accommodation he selects. Now, they're not absolutely bound to provide the accommodation he selects if they provide something which is equally effective. And we submit the record here makes it clear that the accommodation they did provide was not equally effective when compared to real-time captioning.
Real-time isn't even exactly, I mean, people that have looked at it, that it isn't always exactly accurate. The court reporter has to go back and they're taking things down, you know, they understand certain things and then they have to go back and then they have to appropriately comport that to what they're, you know, how they interpret it, how they do their work and all of that. So, you know, allowing someone to look at real time when that's not going to be necessarily the official transcript and a person looking at it doesn't understand exactly how the court reporter does it, could create something misleading.
There's certainly a potential, Your Honor, but I think the record makes it clear that Mr. Rafford was familiar with real-time captioning. He had used it many times in the past.
Well, he knows that, but he doesn't know the court reporter. He doesn't know how the court reporter takes his or her notes, right?
No, he doesn't know that. But I don't think that reaches the essential inequality of the assistive listening device they did provide, where entire portions of the proceeding were not just subject to typographical errors or misspellings. He couldn't hear entire portions of what was going on.
Well, did Judge Thorpe have the real-time captioning in his courtroom?
In his courtroom? No, I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I don't think the record reflects whether he had the necessary equipment. The record
but
makes
he
it clear
use it on a, is that the method of reporting that he regularly used?
Probably not, because he wasn't regularly dealing with people with severe hearing impairment.
Well, but that's not why, but courts don't have real time to accommodate, to do an ADA accommodation. They're doing it for other, I mean, the primary reason for having real time, that, you know, that may be something that is down the line, but that's not why courts have real time. I mean, are you asserting that? I mean, that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not following your question.
Well, courts don't adopt using real time because they're anticipating the event where someone with a hearing disability, a hearing impairment, will want to use it. That's not the purpose of it.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. When a person who is disabled within the coverage.
No. The why courts employ real time as when they make a basis to use that. Are you saying that that is the major reason that they use real time?
To accommodate people with hearing impairments? No, I'm sure it's not.
Okay.
No.
That was my question. I was asking you what's the ordinary practice in the courtroom, because that makes a difference in terms of whether or not the judge ordinarily used real time. If he ordinarily used real time and he refused to use it as an accommodation, that would be a different matter. But I have another question. Who made the ultimate decision whether or not to use real time in the courtroom?
The ultimate decision, the initial decision, was made by the judge.
What about the ultimate decision? That's what she's asking. That's what's troubling to me, Mr. Davis. It looks like Judge Thorpe engaged your client and spoke with him, and the decisions, the shot calling was being done by Judge Thorpe and the county officials who you seek to hold liable for intentional discrimination were following the lead of the judge. He was telling them what kind of accommodation was going to be permitted in his court, and he's immune.
He is immune, Your Honor, if he's acting in a judicial capacity.
Well, you don't question that here, do you? That Judge Thorpe was acting in a judicial capacity?
It's not an issue that we have raised, no. But I think it is clear that the actual accommodating was being done by administrative staff.
But what are they to do? What are they to do when the judge makes the command decision that we're not going to use real time? We're going to use this other method. I've heard the arguments on both sides. Here's what I decide. Are they to challenge him and say no? Judge,
yes, Your Honor. I think they are to challenge him when it becomes clear that the device ordered by the judge is not working.
The judge is the captain of the courtroom. I mean, it's extremely difficult for somebody to say, in your courtroom, here's what you're going to use, despite the fact that you think something else will work better. As a practical matter, how would that work?
I think it is difficult to say no to power, Your Honor. We all know that. And it would have been perhaps difficult for a member of the court staff to tell Judge Thorpe or ask Judge Thorpe to change his mind.
Well, and particularly here where it didn't look like he just made an arbitrary decision. He gave reasons why real time wouldn't work and why he didn't want to use it. And the reasons that he gave seem like the type of reasons that peculiarly a judge would think of and a judge would consider and then exercise discretion, right?
If he had made an inquiry into the circumstances, if he had asked Mr. Rafford, can you control yourself? Are you going to be interrupting my trial? But he didn't do that.
Counsel, who had the authority to approve the accommodations in the record? Who had the authority?
The county policy says that the authority rests with the departmental ADA person.
Where in the record are you citing from to say that the authority rests with the ADA? Because I thought it rested with the judge.
I'm referring, Your Honor, to the administrative policy adopted by the county.
And where is that in the record?
I'm looking for the page, Your Honor, just a moment.
Because I'm looking at ER Volume 2, page 88, paragraph 4, which seems to say that the judge had the authority to approve the use of a particular accommodation. I won't take your time. You can look at it while you're waiting for your rebuttal time.
All right.
Thank you.
And I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
Thank you.
Please proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Doug Morrill. I'm from the Office of the Snohomish County Prosecuting Attorney, and I'm representing defendant appellees Snohomish County in this matter. Addressing a few points that counsel raised in his argument, he attempts to liken this case to Duvall, and I think that's a mistake for some reasons. Obviously, Duvall is the authority we look at in this case. There are important distinctions between this case and Duvall, among them being, in that case, obviously, it's the difference between being a litigant and a spectator.
I understand what you're saying about that, but on the other hand, a courtroom is a public forum, and much like if we were to, you know, say not have ramps so that people could get into the courtroom, I mean, making something a public forum that you are excluding, you know, someone that has a disability or an impairment, you know, it would be a problem. So I'm assuming let's say if for in Duvall the person was a participant and he is a court spectator, albeit, but it was his son's proceeding and he wanted to do that. If we were to conclude that spectators are to be given equal accommodation as participants, would this alter your analysis under Duvall? Did the county intentionally discriminate if that were the case?
It wouldn't, Your Honor. And the reason are the other differences between Duvall. I was raising the difference between a spectator and a litigant, not so much for the proposition that the county has no duty to spectators. That's not something the county's advanced in its briefing, as much for prudential issues as for legal ones. The court's not interested in taking a position that doesn't have to accommodate its spectators.
Well, the technical assistance manual says opposite.
Right. And it's not taking that position. But where I do raise the spectator-litigant distinction is because I think it folds into the analysis of the intent and how you judge the county's intent in its method for choosing an accommodation. And what I mean by that is, and this is not yet addressing your point, Judge Callahan.
Getting there, I assume.
I am getting there, I'm sorry. the point I was making was that if you're looking at, well, what is a reasonable response to this issue, what you do for a litigant might be different than what you do for a spectator. For instance, in this case, if it was Mr. Rafford's son, he's facing the prospect of being civilly committed as a sexually violent predator for a long period of time, potentially. If he couldn't hear, it's a major issue in the trial.
Well, so if a litigant can't hear during the proceedings, that fundamentally affects the fairness of exactly what happens there.
Exactly.
On the other hand, so let's just say that if a litigant had the same faulty hearing that that the appellant is claiming, would that be deliberate indifference?
No, and the answer, or the my response to that gets into the differences between Duvall, and that is it's not just in the fact that he's spectator litigant. It's also the fact that in Duvall, the litigant in that case informed the court that an ALD, assistive listening device, flat out was not going to work for him, and he actually didn't even use it. It's a difference in kind. And on top of that, in Duvall, the court had no prior knowledge of the litigant, of Mr. Duvall in that case. Very different here. The court is well aware of Mr. Rafford for a number of reasons, but also because he actually filed with the Department of Justice a complaint in the years prior asking to get ALD, and the county agreed to provide that. So in looking at the facts of our case, or actually getting back to your hypothetical, if it was the litigant that was having the exact same issues, if the county had pre-knowledge of him, if the litigant had asked for an ALD in the past, and if all the litigant had identified as being wrong with the ALD were relatively minor issues, not something like Duvall where it's, these just are not compatible with my hearing aids, which he had in that case, as opposed to minor issues like people are walking in front of the transmitter and that creates static. Well, the easy response to that is, well, we'll make sure people don't do that. Or people not speaking into microphones, same issue. We'll make sure people speak into microphones. These are relatively easy things to fix. And in our case, the facts of our case, those were the problems that were identified. In Duvall, not so much. Duvall, it was a flat out, this chosen method of accommodation is not going to work for me whatsoever.
What are the facts in this case in the record? When I was asking appellant's counsel, was real time regularly used in this courtroom?
I don't think that's clear in the record. speaking outside the record, I don't know that that's true. But, again, that's nothing appears in the record about whether it was used regularly.
Okay. We have to stick to the record.
Right. I think the other issue that has come up a bit in appellant's argument.
Well, it appears from some of the declarations that it would be an interruption of the trial to set up real time, which is sort of an indication that it wasn't regularly used because if it had to be set up there.
My impression is it wasn't something commonly occurring. But, again, that's something that I don't think anyone submitted a declaration to that effect.
Do you think the county officials had an obligation to buck the judge's decision here?
No, on the facts of this case. And the reason for that being, it's kind of consistent with my argument thus far, and that is, to the county's knowledge, ALD was something that could be an effective accommodation. It was something Mr. Rafford had asked for in the recent past.
I hear kind of a little bit of a weasel here. I'm assuming that you would say that there would be certain circumstances where if a county were aware that a judge were not accommodating pursuant to the ADA and putting the county at risk, that the county should do something.
I'm not trying to be a weasel, certainly, Your Honor.
You said under the circumstances, like, sure. Sort of, I picked up on
sure.
That.
I guess what I meant by that is I was trying to focus on the facts of our case, but in answer to your question, I don't believe that the county necessarily has the power to tell a judge what to do, especially in, as was decided by Chief Judge Lasnik in this decision, Judge Thorpe was entitled to judicial immunity. It was a judicial decision he made, not an administrative one.
Well, that was my question. If, according to the declaration, this was the judge's call and the county officials were just doing whatever the judge, were accommodating whatever the judge decided. So if we assume that it was the judge's decision, how could the county officials buck that decision even in a case where you might think it would be appropriate? How would that work?
I'm not sure they'd have an absolute right to trump his decision. I think they could attempt to talk to the judge, obviously, but I think ultimately it is the judge's call.
I can't imagine somebody dragging equipment into a judge's courtroom over the judge's objection. I don't know how that would work.
And, you know, certainly in Snohomish County, we're very conscious of the separation between, you know, the county's role as the people that fund the facilities and the judge's role in running the courtroom, the GR-29 issue under Washington law. Not something we've briefed necessarily. But I think Your Honors are right in that the county is in a bit of a jam in that circumstance.
Well, would that go to the issue of whether they were being deliberately indifferent?
No. And again, this is where I was weaseling, perhaps, in your words. I think the issue is...
That was not a good word to use, because there's you don't appear in any way to be a weasel. Yeah.
For what it's worth, I'll take it as a compliment, I suppose. The difference being in the facts of our case, I keep trying to go back to the facts of our case, and there may be a case where the circumstance changes, but here what people knew was effectively the same. What the court administrators knew and what Judge Thorpe knew were effectively the same things. That being, ALD is something we, being the court and the county, has used in the past effectively. There have been identified minor issues, but again, actually, the Declaration of Marilyn Finson indicates that they've used it approximately 10 to 12 times a year for jurors and witnesses.
Opposing counsel referenced the plan, the ADA plan for the county, and said that the plan made the Office of Equal Opportunity, or whatever the office is, the human rights, or whatever that office is, responsible for the accommodation decisions. What's your response to that?
The policy he referenced, and it's evidentiary record 35 and 36 of the pages where it exists. Let me double check that. 38 and 39. Sorry. Mm-hmm. The significance of that is it's a policy adopted by the executive's office, and it's certainly something the court attempts to abide by, but it's not necessarily binding on a court. For the GR-29 issue I read about, talked about before, the GR-29 issue is the state rule adopted by our Supreme Court. I believe the court attempted to follow it, but ultimately it doesn't mean what it says. I mean, the judge is still going to control his courtroom. The county doesn't have the authority to trump what a judge wants to do. If, in fact, that's deemed a violation of that policy, I would point to the decision in, I think it's Memmer, which was cited by Duvall, actually, where in that case there was a violation of policy of the defendant, and the court ultimately said that wasn't something of import. That's not necessarily per se a violation of the ADA. The underlying concern is whether an accommodation is provided. And that kind of folds in actually to the other point I'd been trying to get to, but haven't yet.
Well, you need to wrap up because you're
attempting to.
Your time.
Oh, I'm sorry. The point I was trying to make is that it's very easy to confuse the issues here between was an effective accommodation provided as opposed to judging, well, what was the level of the county's intent? And in some, I think Chief Judge Lasnik got it right in looking at the totality of the circumstances. You're looking at someone that's requested ALD in the past, even litigated it, well, to the extent that filing a complaint with the DOJ is litigation, has asked for it to that degree, and we're providing it. And there's further evidence of the court bending over backwards to make it work, and no indication it wouldn't work.
All right, so. Counsel, thank you. Rebuttal. We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal. 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel has pointed out the pages that I was going to point out to the court as well. I fully understand your concern about and our recognition that the judge controls his or her courtroom. No question about that. But if that was the end of the analysis, that's where Duvall would have stopped. There is an additional layer of administrative action that comes into play here, and it's that administrative action that we think didn't happen as a result of deliberate indifference. None of the administrative staff could have dragged that equipment into the courtroom over the judge's objection, but they could have told the judge, Your Honor, Mr. Rafford has made it clear to us that this is just not working. Would you reconsider? They could have asked that. No indication in the record that they did. And I think that's where the crux of this case lies.
So that question, if they had they done that, there would not be deliberate indifference? Is that your concession?
If they had done all they could to accommodate him.
Well, if they'd asked the judge and the judge said no, if they'd said, Judge, we'll bring this equipment in, we'll do that or whatever, but the judge says no, and the judge is the captain of the ship, I'm hearing you say that's not deliberate, then there would be no deliberate indifference.
If the judge was acting within his capacity as a judge, if this was a judicial act, the decision on how to accommodate Mr. Rafford, if that was a judicial act, then the judge is immune, that's the end of it.
Well,
it goes no further.
You conceded that in this case, right?
In this case, I did concede it, Your Honor. I was responding to the hypothetical. It was clear from the very first time Mr. Rafford made his request for an accommodation at his son's trial that the ALDs, which he had used in the past, were subject to problems. It's not as though this problem was raised by Mr. Rafford for the first time at his son's trial. When he spoke with Mr. Knutson, when he wrote the letter, he explained that there had been problems in the past with the ALDs. And this is more than just a passing problem that could be cured. It wasn't cured, and the record indicates that there was an entire portion of the trial that Mr. Rafford couldn't hear.
All right. Thank you, counsel. You've exceeded your time. Thank you to both counsel. The case just argued is submitted for a decision by the court.